I have to say that writing and giving this paper has been a bit of an exercise in nostalgia for me. Firstly, because I'm following Chris Dyer, who, again, more years ago, even more years ago than Peter was talking about, than either of us would care to remember, he was actually my special subject tutor at Birmingham and provided me, I think, with the basic tools for thinking historically about communities in conflict. And what I'm going to be doing is a sort of reverse of what he did earlier today, which is to say, well, okay, what we know about the French urban parish is about violence and conflict. It's about, and so it's a very unromanticised view, if you like. And I'm trying to sort of not put the romance back in, because that would be rather difficult to do, but at least to try and think about it along the lines of the fact that, as Peter said, I've been working on sort of pacification and actually attempts for confessional coexistence in France, to actually think about the parish as a meaningful space for people who look as though they've rejected it, if you like. So that's the aim of this paper. Quite well, whether I'll achieve that aim, we'll see. Secondly, in terms of the nostalgia of writing this paper, in order to think about the parish, I've had to go back to some of the research I first undertook as part of my PhD, which was on Troyes, as Peter mentioned. There it is. I shall be returning to the violence again in a minute. Troyes in Champagne is known as the bouchon de Champagne, the cork of Champagne, which, and you can see by its shape, this is how the tourist office advertises Troyes. And if I begin to sound like, somebody sort of advertising the attractions of visiting Troyes, I make no apologies for that. Because actually, as we'll go on to see, quite a lot of the sort of fabric does survive. Well, as so often when you return to old material, I found that you see it through fresh eyes, the different kind of set of research questions, which illuminate it in ways that perhaps you didn't see quite the same way before. And in some ways, again, going back to this kind of theme of nostalgia, it's going to be the theme of my talk today in considering, as I say, how those who chose to reject Catholic devotions responded to the parish to which they belonged and in which they continued to live, despite its obvious association with the faith they decided to denounce. So I'm going to be nuancing the conflict and violence of my title with some more conciliatory observations, although the conflict and violence, as always when you're studying the French religious wars, are rather hard to avoid. But to begin with, as many of you are perhaps less familiar with the contours of the French Reformation than you are with the English, I thought it'd be helpful to provide you with a quick overview of the context of what I'll actually be talking about. And with this slide, which is the most well-known depiction of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which is probably the event of the French religious wars that most people are familiar with, even if they know not much more about it, and of course reinforces that theme of violence, which is part of my focus today. Well, in France, compared to many other parts of Europe, the French Reformation took some decades to get going. It only really became a significant movement in the 1540s and 1550s, in particular with support from Calvin's Geneva, and it's really only in that period that Calvin sort of establishes his base in Geneva. And it's worth remembering that the Calvinist Church is the French Reformed Church in exile. So effectively, a lot of their efforts are concentrated on France. Nevertheless, by 1560, at its height, it's estimated that Protestantism had been embraced by some 10% of the French population, a substantial enough minority to threaten the stability of the French polity. Even more so, in that perhaps up to half the nobility, it's estimated, were converted to Protestantism, or at least professed it at various times, and that the movement was particularly prominent in the major towns of the kingdom. So up to perhaps 20% of the population in major towns like Rouen and Lyon, two of the largest towns, and eventually forming a majority in towns, particularly in the south, like Montauban and Nîmes. More significant still, there was a genuine fear among Catholics that, like the English monarchy, the French king might be persuaded to support the movement. And indeed, in many ways, and this is actually quite a source of debate among historians, French historians, France had long seemed a more likely location for Reformation than was England. I won't go into the reasons for that, but you can perhaps ponder that one. This was never to be the case, of course. France, of course, remained Catholic, but the French crown chose instead a path of reconciliation and toleration, in the sense of putting up with the Protestant subjects of the kingdom. Since the Protestants were simply too numerous to simply repress, the minority was big enough that it caused trouble and it couldn't just simply be wiped out. Coexistence, though, was extremely fraught. Relations between the faiths were tense, especially with the intermittent civil wars that ensued on and off from 1562 until the end of the century. And episodes such as the infamous St. Bartholomew's Massacre of Huguenots in Paris in 1572 heightened a state of mutual suspicion and fear. In the urban communities of France, boundaries between the faiths and within the community needed to be constantly negotiated and redrawn. And as with the Jews in the Middle Ages, it was not the practice of another faith that was used to justify their persecution so much, particularly because of this royal policy of toleration, but rather their supposedly active hostility to the Catholic faith. And that's something I'll return to. It's the fact that they pose a threat to the faith, not just that they practice another faith, but I think it's the threat that they pose that causes the particular problems. Now, urban studies have often highlighted the degree of sociability and solidarity within the pre-modern parish, but also the opportunity provided for tension and conflict. Perhaps we'll return to the plot at this point. It's reasonable to assume that confessional division broke down existing bonds and ties between adherents of different faiths. And recent work on bi or multi-confessional communities in various parts of Europe, however, have demonstrated how confessional groups could live alongside one another and even make use of the same parochial space, sharing churches and other facilities such as cemeteries. This is much less the case for France. There are various examples where churches were shared for a brief period, cemeteries even more so, but these are very unusual examples. On the whole, sacred space of that sort was not shared between the faiths, and that's a reflection really of the antagonisms that there were in France. Protestantism in France remained very much a minority faith, and interconfessional antagonisms remained intense. So what I want to do today is really to explore just how useful the parish remains, if we're going to talk about religious conflict in this way, as a space to think with once the Reformation, in Catholic countries like France at least, had emerged as a divisive force. Does the parish have any meaning for those people who had resided in it but then sort of rejected it by conversion? And indeed, whether urban parish boundaries still have meaning to a beleaguered religious minority in this context. And in doing so, I've been taken back to research I undertook many years ago, as well as looking at what other historians have said about the role of the parish in their urban studies of the period of the religious wars. And what I found, actually looking at various urban studies, and quite a lot of them for France in this period, their use of parish records for thinking about reconstructing confessional relations varies a great deal, and this is largely dependent on the survival or otherwise of relevant sources. And I'll return to this issue of the problems of sources in actually reconstructing things like confessional relations in relation to what I'm doing today. It's fair to say that in many cases we only get to the Protestants through Catholic sources. And as I say, I'll return to this problem later because it's germane to what I'm talking about today. And although actually, you know, having moved away from a single urban study, I've continued to mine provincial archives. It's been very much in relation to a much more sort of nationwide project that eschews the kind of close analysis which is necessary, I think. For it's only in the context of a local study, as we know, inevitably, that the parish context can properly be mapped out. So that took me back to Troyes in that sense. Now, one of the great unresolved issues of the historiography of the French religious wars is how best to explain who, or rather which groups, were attracted to the Reformed faith and why. And I quite like this image of since Crépin, Crépin-Pignan, as it would be said in French, which actually is in one of the churches in Troyes. And I like it because these people are depicted in contemporary dress, in 16th century dress, but obviously it's a depiction of the arrest of the saints who become sort of martyrs for their faith. And I think it rather talks to the fact that other people are being arrested in Troyes at this time for defending a different faith to that of the majority in this context. So I quite like this image for thinking about that, although it's very much a Catholic image, in fact. Now, neat delineations used to be made about who was attracted to the Reformed faith and why, on the basis of social status and occupation. whilst eschewing over simplistic economic determinism. Thus, the higher status and more literate craft groups, such as goldsmiths, printers, and so on, were seen as disproportionately more likely to become Protestant, and so too members of the liberal professions, such as lawyers, doctors, and so on. However, although a broad consensus was reached, this approach didn't easily explain why certain craft groups, such as hosiers in Rouen, and as we'll see, the joiners in Troyes, were particularly well represented among the converts. And what you tend to find is there's particular crafts in particular cities that are particularly overrepresented, if you like. It's hard to explain specifically why this is. And again, I need to emphasise here really the difficulty of establishing just who is Protestant, because that is a genuine difficulty in very many cases, since very few places have Protestant registers, for instance, of baptism surviving from the period, comparable to the ones you'd use to reconstruct Catholic populations. There are some lists of Protestants that survive, but these are often distorted through the lens of the usually judicial authorities who drew them up. So perhaps those caught attending a clandestine meeting, we'll see more of that later, those involved in a riot or victims of a massacre, may or may not be representative, of course, of their co-religionists as a whole. They're often of quite high status, for instance, because those are the people who tend to be targeted by the judicial authorities, and the most conspicuous members, if you like, of the movement. So although people do extrapolate from these kinds of sources, you can see the kinds of problems that might rise from them. In a study of Dijon, James Farr suggested that neighbourhood was a more important factor than craft group or profession. So it's a way of rethinking, really, who's attracted to Protestantism. And this is reinforced by the contemporary identification of certain streets with the Reformed faith, as with the Rue des Forges in Dijon, and, as we'll see, the Rue Moyenne in Troyes, and I shall return to the Rue Moyenne quite a bit. And of course, often the close proximity of those working in a craft, often sharing workshops and equipment or tools, often living in the same streets for various practical reasons, as well as because sometimes that's delineated by the authorities. Just as so-called notables tended to congregate in the more salubrious parts of town, would work in this regard with regard to the idea that it's certain neighbourhoods that are attracted to the Reform movement. That would also fit with the crafts coming into that movement as well, sort of together, because they tend to be neighbours as well. But perhaps rather riskily, I want to take a step further, than this, and suggest that the parish continued to be a particularly powerful source of neighbourhood solidarity for these craftsmen, even after the conversion, and just as it was for their neighbours, whether Protestant or Catholic. I think, so I'll go on to explain why I think this, I think there's something in that, to think about the parish as an existing solidarity, which actually doesn't necessarily break down just because you convert. Right. Okay, thinking about the parish on the one side, if we go back actually to the way that it's divided up for the authorities' purposes is in very practical terms into quarters. For the practical purposes of taxation and organisation of the night watch, for instance, there's frequent demarcation of urban communities into quarters or other districts. As for the watch, this was divided up again into what are known as garde and dizaine. But I think these sorts of divisions, apart from obviously for tax collecting purposes, have had really very little significance when it came to everyday social interaction and a sense of belonging, which the parish, I think, seems to have provided very much more, and that's no particular surprise there. But at least at first, I think that Protestants were not at all interested in throwing off these kinds of solidarities, as of course their co-religionists in England would never have to do because the whole country becomes Protestant, despite the parish clearly being a Catholic construct. After all, Protestants believed that they were restoring the practices of the early church, not establishing a new set of devotions, and were keen to hold on to their associations with their ancestors, who they believed had been misled by a corrupt clergy. Thus, for instance, as I've written about extensively before, they sought to be buried alongside their ancestors. So they wanted to be buried in the parish cemetery, or indeed even in the church. Despite increasing objections, unsurprisingly, from Catholics, that they would thereby be polluting sacred ground, leading to instances, and there are quite a number of these, and they're in Troyes, but they're also elsewhere, where Catholics would dig up Protestant bodies, which often were themselves buried secretly by their co-religionists at night. And there are various sort of stories of how bodies are put into graves that have been dug on top of bodies that were buried during that day, and they're buried too high and dogs dig them up. And there's all kinds of rather unpleasant ideas of corpses really travelling around the town in various what seem almost comic ways, but of course to the people concerned would not have been at all comical. But there's a real battleground there over the continuing use by the Protestants of parish facilities, if you like, after they've rejected the parish. And again, this is something I really want to, a theme I want to return to. And so this notion of pollution is an important one, and something that's informed a lot of writing about the French religious wars. In the case of burials, as well as of baptisms and religious services, the Protestants sought to retain these within their local churches and cemeteries to a large extent. As I mentioned, there is some sharing, but very little. So what I'm trying to argue really is it wasn't the Protestants' choice that they were excluded from these places. They didn't reject them, but were forced out, effectively, as largely happens to all minorities when they're perceived to pose a threat to the majority. And I'm not sort of making a kind of anti-Catholic statement here about how those nasty Catholics pushed them out, because on the other side, from the Catholic perspective, there was a real, very real concern about the Huguenot presence in their midst as a threat during the wars, particularly early in the wars in 1562. They're actually seizing control of towns, and so there was a real fear of them as traitors within the community. And a real, really strong feeling that their rejection of parochial bonds, represented by their rejection of Catholicism, led to questioning why they should be allowed to continue to use the parish cemetery or be allowed to worship within the town, within the locality. And they had, in a sense, distanced themselves from these bonds. So therefore, the fact that Catholic efforts were made to distance them in terms of their cemeteries, as I'll go on to talk about, were established quite far out from city precincts, and their services even more so that they were to travel out to. Right. Inevitably then, despite their supposed attachment to the parish, the non-participation and sometimes active rejection or disruption of the usual devotional practices associated with it by Protestants exacerbated tensions with their Catholic neighbours. The failure to decorate their houses on feast days, for instance, or to venerate religious statues and the Eucharist, the eating of meat at times when it was forbidden, and non-participation in processions, and the actual challenging of the clergy during sermons or in the street, as well as acts of iconoclasm and provocative psalm singing, all of these things greatly offended Catholic sensibilities. And the most infamous clashes between the faiths prior to the wars took place in urban parishes. This is very much an urban event, if you like, in the French case. Notably in Paris, the flashpoints involving the supposed disruption of Catholic services, as in the Rue Saint-Jacques in 1557 and in the parish of Saint-Médard in 1561. And what tended to happen in these circumstances, it's when congregations are coming up against each other. They're really worshipping in too close a proximity, and there's a disturbance of one by the other. Such events, as well as the politically sensitive nature of allowing Protestant worship in the kingdom's capital, led to the exclusion of Reformed services from Paris, even when they were permitted, indeed when provision was required by the crown elsewhere. So you've got a very interesting circumstance in which Reformed worship has to take place throughout the kingdom, except a certain distance around Paris, and in Paris itself, and except where the king is. So actually but everybody else has to put up with it. And I think that also leads to tensions as well, as a sense that there are exceptions are made. So it's all very well for the crown to say, you have to have Reformed services, but actually they're distanced from the crown itself and from the capital. And indeed, when we consider the two most infamous events of the wars, this association with the parish as a flashpoint of conflict is reinforced. The massacre of Protestants at Vassy in Champagne in March 1562, which is depicted here by the Catholic Duke of Guise's men, is traditionally seen as the first act of the war. And it came about as a result of the affront given by Reformed worship in a barn, only a stone's throw from the local parish church, as we see in the background here. The church is there, a couple of members of the Guise family are leaning over the wall to have a look at what's going on. the massacre here. And in fact, if you go to Vassy today, although the barn doesn't no longer exists and indeed was demolished shortly after this, you can there's a sort of little museum to it, so you can see where it's located, and the church is indeed very close to it. So there would have been a great deal of disturbance one way or the other. In Paris, in 1572, with the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, the Protestants who were mostly living in the district of Saint-Germain-des-Prés on the left bank here, there's a sort of Notre-Dame de la Cité and Louvre is over here, that's the Saint-Germain, were prevented from escaping by the closing of the Saint-Germain gate, which is here. But of course, since the parish was a basic unit of division in any city, I can see that you'd argue that every event and street was located within a parish. So in a sense, all these things obviously take place in a parish. So is there really any point in drawing attention to this? And whereas most French urban studies have looked at the parish only in relation to evidence of Catholic devotions, either waning or strengthening in response to the Protestant threat, to say what I want to do is to make a case for its continuing importance to the Protestant community, at least in the short term. So, in order to embrace this challenge, and it is a bit of a challenge, I think, probably, and I'll be very interested to see whether you think it works in any way at all, I'm going to return to my focus for today, which is Troyes, and specifically the parish of Saint-Jean. Just to say a bit about Troyes itself, well, how I got to thinking about Saint-Jean, if you like. Actually, the next slide might help in this respect. I came across this when I was going through my notes, which is a map that I, you know, you can see that it's the hand-drawn version of the properly printed version. And I went hatching Saint-Jean as a parish, just to give you a sense of where it is. Between the Rue du Conseil, the Rue de la Grande Tannerie, the Rue Mayenne at the top there, which, as I say, I'll say quite a lot about, and Saint-Jean itself is number 5 there, but you get a better impression from that where it is than going back to the other map. This perhaps is a bit clearer. And when I was thinking about what was going on with regard to the tensions within Troyes, there was this very much this focus, as we'll go on to see, on the Rue Moyenne as the area. I felt that this wasn't the only place that things were going on. It was going on in this kind of area, as we'll go on to see. I thought, well, that doesn't really work with regard to quarters. It sort of straddles the boundary between Conseil down here and Comporte up there. And then I realised there was a unit that corresponded to a lot of this conflict. Now, it's not the only place the conflict takes place, but a great deal of it does take place there. Saint-Jacques is a sort of poorer quarter of the city. There's not much Protestant activity there. Belfoy is the more upmarket end, and there's not much going on there either. So it's very much a central area, but very much the Rue Moyenne down rather than the whole thing. The other thing about Saint-Jean is I thought, well, okay, people would probably like to get a sense of Saint-Jean itself. To give you some images, you'll see why it's very difficult to get a decent image of Saint-Jean. This is an aerial view because it's the only way you can really get a good view of the whole thing. You can get a sort of street level view of one side, and that's quite a narrow street going down there. It's probably not quite as clear as it might be. Saint-Jean-le-Marché, so it's right in the marketplace, as we'll go on to look at. You can see how it's hemmed in still by houses and sort of narrow streets down either side of it, and that's one of the sort of typical tourist views of Troyes. And indeed, what's fortunate, or for us rather than for the inhabitants of Troyes, there's a very big fire there in 1524, which destroyed a great deal of the town. And certainly the wooden houses had to be rebuilt. So a lot of it actually survives from that period. A lot of it is early 16th century, in fact. And all the stone churches, thank goodness, the medieval churches survived. But a lot of the townhouses actually date from the sort of early 16th century. So it's well worth visiting from that point of view. You can get a sense of how narrow the streets were and those sorts of issues, which is obviously germane to how much, you know, violence between neighbours in these circumstances. And so, as I say, this is sort of parish I'm looking at. Just have a quick look here. What we have with Saint-Jean is that it encompasses very much it's right at the heart of the community, right here by the markets as well, the marché au blé, the corn market, and the étape au vin here. I'm quite interested in this in particular because the étape au vin is actually where a lot of people actually ended up being executed for heresy in the 1540s, for instance. So, you know, that's right by where all these later Protestants were sort of to live, in the Rue Moyenne, sort of concentrated here. And there are various sort of flashpoints, as I'll go on to talk about, along this sort of street and its sort of boundaries, and it encompasses some important landmarks. Right. Okay, so it's right in the middle of the town, so I think that in a sense does explain why there's a lot of conflict there as well. But it doesn't explain why the Protestants are particularly concentrated there, I think it's fair to say. Most significantly, the Rue Moyenne was said to be largely populated by Huguenot craftsmen. So this is very much the sort of area where the craftsmen are based, the more posh Protestants, if you like, the merchants and so on, are down here in the Rue du Temple. We'll also go back to Rue de la Grande Tannerie later, where the leather workers are based and nicely on the river so they can wash their hides and so on there. So that's the sort of location of a lot of both the conflict and of the Huguenots themselves. In particular, as I mentioned, it's the joiners of Troyes who were particularly concentrated in the Rue Moyenne. And I think Chris is particularly going to like this because they're described at the time by a Protestant source as all good men, robust and spirited, and of the religion. Robust and spirited, I take to mean they're up for a fight, really, and they certainly do get involved in quite a lot of the major events. Some of them get killed themselves. They're also doing some of the killing. So there is very much a focus, and both Catholics and Protestants at the time recognised Rue Moyenne as the main focus of Huguenot activity and antagonism, and the Rue Moyenne, as you'll see, runs right past Saint-Jean, right on that side of it. And this causes a particular amount of conflict with the clergy of the parish. So you might say, well, why don't I just stick with the Rue Moyenne? Why take it further and talk about the parish more generally? As I say, we find that other Huguenots are living in locations around there, the merchants and the notables in the Rue du Temple, as I mentioned. And this has a similar reputation for being a Protestant stronghold. They don't have as many fights. That seems to be the difference. But it's certainly seen as a place where Protestant activity takes place. Thus, whereas the streets were fairly socially demarcated in this way, I think we can say that groups of varied social status coexisted in the parish, as they did in the Reformed Church, Reformed community. If not without some tensions between them in both cases, it's fair to say that you can talk about a certain amount of tension between the different groups of social status, particularly around issues like iconoclasm. There's a feeling among the notables that this is presumably the same source that describes the joiners as robust also describes those who carry out iconoclasm as hot-headed, and there's probably a close link between them. But there's felt that the acts of iconoclasm are too provocative and actually provoking Catholic aggression. And there's a difference of opinion about that between the artisans and the notables. And I think thinking about the parish as a unit as well, and thinking about its role for people, as Hilary Bernstein has pointed out for Poitiers, the parish provided numerous opportunities for individuals to have an impact on their local community and to influence public affairs in a way that the much more restricted holding of municipal office, which was largely confined to an urban elite, did not. Although that seems to depend on the sort of social mix within the particular parish. Furthermore, Bernstein states that positive values were attached to parish involvement and allowed even Protestants to act as vestrymen and to collect contributions to poor relief in the 1540s and 1550s. I was a bit puzzled by this statement, the idea of Protestants acting as vestrymen and collecting contributions to poor relief as if that was unproblematic. It's notoriously hard to begin with to identify who held Protestant beliefs, especially before the late 1550s, which is really when they come out into the open. So you can't really very confidently talk about anybody being a Protestant in France in the 1540s unless they're burned for it quite often. So these are, I think what she means is, these are later converts. These are people who later become Protestant, or may have been secretly Protestant, but only openly become Protestant later on. But it does underline what historians have found elsewhere, as I did for Troyes, that far from being the most detached from their parish, those later to become Protestant were often prominent among those holding parochial office or duties, or making contributions to particular cults or confraternities, and were religiously committed and active. Payments for anniversaries for deceased relatives by such individuals, for instance, were commonplace even in the mid-1550s. So they were well integrated into their parish community and had a vested interest and say within it. And I think that these are attachments which they were probably reluctant to relinquish, hoping for a reformation that would allow for parish life to continue as before, cleansed of its trappings of papal idolatry. For quite other reasons, Protestants would also continue to have their children baptised in the local parish church until a reformed option was available with the arrival of clandestine ministers by the late 1550s, after which it was really frowned upon once they had their own ministers to administer baptism. Or in the case of burial, as late as 1570, when Protestants were first permitted to have their own cemeteries, which, as we've seen, caused a conflict. In Saint-Jean, which is nice, I'll go for that one, at least 11 prominent Huguenots had their children baptised there in the mid-1550s, but the registers also reveal that they stood as godparents to each other's offspring, which suggests that their growing identity as a group and support network based in the parish. Unsurprisingly, in view of its confessional mix, a number of notable clashes between the faiths took place in the parish of Saint-Jean, especially in the early 1560s. More specifically, individual incidents in the Rue Moyenne, or Little Geneva, as it was sarcastically called by the Catholics, which is the same name that was used for other streets in other cities, such as the Rue Saint-Jacques in Paris. They've said it was the home to many Protestant joiners, such as generations of the Collot family, who I think were a rather robust group who seemed to be involved in quite a lot of the violent conflicts of the period. And the situation there provoked tensions and sometimes violence. And it seems to have particularly come to the fore to the attention of the authorities in 1560. One night in August 1560, for instance, a statue of the Virgin was desecrated with the body of a cat put round its neck, and filth, or ordure, as the French term is, smeared upon it. This actually took place right at the edge of the parish up here. This shocking act of iconoclasm confirmed the perception that Protestants had not only rejected Catholic beliefs, but were a direct threat to and assault upon Catholic devotions. The cat is seen very much as a symbol of unbridled sexuality. The other thing they did with cats was throw them at priests, when they were processing, to indicate that they were not sticking to their chastity. And there seems to be a lot of ordure flying around in France during this period in general, because certainly Huguenots get pelted with it as well. But the subsequent procession of absolution after the iconoclastic event the following day was aborted when those taking part scattered when a rumour spread that the inhabitants of the Rue Moyenne were preparing to attack them, whilst its residents, it was reported by the Protestants, were actually barricaded in their houses for fear of Catholic reprisals, revealing the mutual anxiety and distrust of the faiths in this parish. In the same year, the disruption of a Corpus Christi procession in the parish reinforces this view. Although Protestants claimed that the clergy were deliberately trying to provoke them, both by organising the procession down the street of the Rue Moyenne and encouraging local children to throw stones at them, so they said it was under this attack that the Protestants had retaliated in self-defence. And processions featuring the Holy Sacrament were subsequently suspended by the ecclesiastical authorities to avoid further confrontation, but also exacerbating, of course, the source of Catholic resentment. The Catholics resented the fact that they couldn't have the host carried in processions because of the Protestants. Alternatively, it was suggested that an armed guard might be necessary for the processions, and certainly later on, the Protestants actually have armed guards for their services. Later in the 1560s, processions outside the city gates were also abandoned for fear of assault by Protestant soldiers. So the statue as a parochial landmark, the procession as an act of parochial solidarity, Protestant actions, even when passive through non-participation, suggested a rejection of the bonds of the parish community. In addition, as Protestants began from 1561 onwards to publicly hold their own services and even baptisms within the parish of Saint-Jean, notably in the Rue du Temple, they tend to hold it in people's houses, and the people in the Rue du Temple had bigger houses, so that's where they tended to congregate, and quite openly and in public, even though, and this again is quite common in France, even though in theory it's not legal at that time. We have the Rue du Temple, where Protestant and Catholic merchants and notables live cheek by jowl. And these services are going on until intramural worship was forbidden in 1562. And these practices seem to sort of confirm this view of rejection of the bonds of the parish community. As indeed did the discovery of a clandestine meeting in 1567, primarily of leather workers, appropriately enough, as I mentioned, in the Rue de la Grande Tannerie, underlining that the Protestants were not to be trusted, it was an illegitimate act, and they were a disruptive force by this taking place. But also I think it reflects perhaps, and there's about 30 people gathered in the home of a leather worker, which was probably a bit of a squeeze, to be honest, in the Rue de la Grande Tannerie, and neighbours are reporting on who's been coming and going, and so that says, tells you something about the relationships between those neighbours as well. But I think it also perhaps suggests that they preferred to carry on with their worship locally for a variety of reasons. I mean, practical considerations, certainly. Much, much easier, obviously, to hold a service in your house than to have to go, actually, quite a long distance by this point to the official place of worship, which was far-flung and difficult, indeed, to go to and back in the morning even, and very difficult for artisans when they've got sort of work to be getting on with, and it seems to be artisans who particularly resist this. They also risked attack by Catholics as they went in and out of the city gates. In order to go out to these services, it was very obvious which gates they were going to take, and often there would be groups lying in wait for them to taunt them or perhaps throw things at them. And this wasn't an infrequent occurrence in towns right across France. But arguably too, I think, because they wanted to maintain their worship within the community, with their neighbours in the parish, I think you could argue. And unlike Philip Benedict's suggestion for Rouen, here's one for Bayat, I have no particular evidence that local Protestants ceased going to local taverns to drink, as he says happened in Rouen, and I'm quite happy to continue reinforcing this neighbourly solidarity. I have no evidence either way, but certainly no evidence that they're not doing so. I want to say a bit more about the sort of problem of sources and what we have for actually thinking about these kinds of conflicts and how they sort of pan out. There are familiar sources to you, anybody working in the sort of parish context, like baptismal registers. As I say, rarely do Protestant ones survive. You have to do quite a lot of detective work to work out what's happening with the Protestants when there's forced rebaptism, which takes place at various stages during the wars. And baptism is indeed an interesting confessional, but also parochial battleground in those terms. As elsewhere in France, such as at Nantes and in Rouen, parish baptismal registers reveal efforts to, if you like, reintegrate children into the community at times of persecution, notably in 1562 and 1572, after sort of notorious massacres and persecution. In contrast to the fact that the baptisms tend to take place in your local parish church, so as I say, a reintegration into the parish community, abjurations, in other words, when people are actually rejecting their Protestant faith and returning to the Catholic Church, tended to take place in the town's cathedral, which is just here. And I think that is a political statement as much as anything else, a conscious piece of political propaganda to have them go to the cathedral to abjure, rather than allowing them to do it more quietly in their parish, although that might have gone on as well, as I'll go on to say something about. Of course, rebaptisms were not canonically necessary nor theologically sound, but can be read as an important public gesture of domination, if you like, but also perhaps of reconciliation of those former sort of Protestants. In Twine, the baptismal register of the parish church of Saint-Jean for August 1562, there are 18 entries which unusually record the ages of the children, ranging from 1 month to 6 years. Baptism of the older children often having taken place abroad in an established Protestant refuge, for instance, such as Geneva, and this is sometimes listed, formally baptised in Geneva. It was claimed, and what gives them away is the age of these children on the whole. They don't necessarily say that they're Huguenots, but the fact that obviously they're of a certain age suggests that very much that they would be. It was claimed by Protestant sources that some were renamed with more suitably Catholic names. But there's actually very little evidence for this. It certainly happens in some places, but I don't think so in Troyes. Many retain the notably Old Testament names favoured by the Protestants, such as David, Judy, Isaiah, Rebecca, Ezekiel and Suzanne. And in some places, a humane case is actually made that the children should be allowed to keep their names, especially because they're older children. They're used to sort of responding to that name, and suddenly giving them a different name is going to be rather confusing. And actually, sometimes there is some compliance on that front. Parish rebaptism was unsurprisingly also common in 1572. Some of those children were even older again because of the sort of passage of time. In the wake of the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, smaller scale versions of which actually took place in many major French towns, including Troyes and Rouen in the subsequent 6 weeks. And it seems to have taken place in towns where there was still a significant minority of Protestants who'd been causing problems over the preceding years. So it does seem to be very targeted. Philip Benedict, in his study of confessional relations in Rouen, estimated that in addition to these rebaptisms, up to 3,000 Protestants undertook an act of reconciliation with the Catholic Church, either very publicly in the cathedral or less conspicuously through payment in their parish church. And I suspect social status played some part here. And he also talks about the fact that these practices continued even well after the coercive period of persecution was over. And also, it's notable that in these northern communities, as you see, so places like Rouen and Troyes, even when peace was later declared, most didn't return to Protestantism, as they would have done really in the 1560s, but preferred to reintegrate into their parish. Similarly, in Troyes, abjurations were both more numerous and more enduring in 1572 than they had been a decade earlier. And those rebaptised at Saint-Jean in 1572 included the children of at least four of the victims of the local massacre before, during and after their imprisonment and subsequent deaths, as well as the children of other familiar Protestant names in the parish. What's interesting also about 1572 is that these rebaptisms are much harder to spot, as this time their ages aren't given, so you can only do it if you know who the Protestants are by this stage. And as I say, there are problems with always knowing, but certainly most of the prominent ones you can spot. Fewer Old Testament names are being used as well. And this is and a similar pattern seems to be the case in Rouen too. And Benedict has suggested that this is because the Protestants are actually deliberately making themselves less conspicuous. They're generally less strident about their faith in keeping with their declining position in the community. And as I say, in northern communities, they become very much a dwindling minority by the early 1570s, whereas through the 1560s they're actually quite a force to be reckoned with. In Troyes, as in Rouen, public abjurations took place in the cathedral, as I've mentioned, in 1562 and in 1572, though some former Protestants paid extra to be absolved outside normal hours, which again is interesting. And all received a certificate to prove their new status, presumably as a means of protection against those who might question it or still thought of them as Protestant. You can imagine a situation in which your neighbour might accuse you of still being a Protestant and you're able to produce your certificate of Catholicity, as they call it. And by this time, I think, therefore, the stark choice for most Protestants was either abjuration or exile. And that seemed to be very much the choice. Either you choose to reintegrate or you go into exile if you're not prepared to do that. And this was very different to the minority's relatively firm positions, as I say, in earlier periods. Although many Protestants went into temporary exile during periods of persecution within France or abroad, chiefly to the Swiss cantons or to England, they often returned soon after when conditions eased, so they often only go away for a few months at a time. That would no longer be the case in many communities, as I say, after 1572, when the concentration of Huguenot strongholds is really very much in the southwest, and we tend to think of that as the stronghold of the Protestant faith in France, the southwest, the Huguenot Crescent, as it's called, between Dauphiné and La Rochelle. But I think, arguably, up to 1572, the northern communities have quite strong Protestant presence as well. But if I'm to sort of make use of this sort of case for the importance of the parish, with, you know, as having, or it's the space of the parish, if you like, that it's in continuing importance for Protestants, we need more than the example of Saint-Jean in Troyes, clearly. This example needs to be tried out elsewhere, so I'm quite happy for other people to try it out elsewhere. But in Rouen, for instance, Benedict, and he's very fortunate because he has some Protestant baptismal registers, for instance, and lots more records of the Protestants, so he's able to identify them much more clearly. He has identified a particular parish as being the base of the Protestant stronghold as well. So this is suggesting that I'm not completely, you know, going off on a tangent. The parish of Saint-Éloi in Rouen was a particular bastion of Protestantism in the city, including the largest numbers of number of rebaptisms in 1572, along with a couple of nearby parishes in the southwest of the town. However, Benedict also demonstrated that the most militant Catholic parishes also adjoined these Huguenot strongholds, suggesting that the Catholic hostility was driven by their proximity to the Protestant inhabitants and being up close to their activities, and perhaps offended, again, by the sort of issues around parish sensibilities. So too in Troyes, Catholic families such as the cobblers, the Perrault, who were guardians of the desecrated statue in the Rue Moyenne, were opposed to the presence of their Protestant neighbours, especially the Collot that I mentioned before. Indeed, it actually ends in violence with one of the Perrault actually murdering one of the Collot. And in the Rue du Temple, Christophe Ludeau was given away to the authorities by his neighbour and fellow merchant Pierre d'Aubeterre in 1572, basically told them where he was hiding, and he would later be murdered in the prisons. But other instances could also be given when a Catholic stepped in to protect one of his or her Protestant neighbours. And indeed, these networks often appear to have been quite gendered. Women tend to conceal women and men. And equally, some of the fights that happen tend to be quite gendered as well, with women pursuing other women along the street, shouting abuse at them and hurling things at them and so on. As everyday activities in general kind of gendered, obviously that feeds into that. In addition to thinking about the fact that neighbourliness, again, doesn't necessarily break down just because your neighbours convert, in addition, an unusual house-to-house survey of the inhabitants' opinions in Troyes about the location of reformed services in the town suburbs, for which, fortunately for our purposes, only one survival of one of the quarters is complete for us, and that's the quarter of Comporte, thankfully. So it does encompass the Rue Moyenne. Demonstrates the most vocal concentration of anti-Protestant feeling was in and around the Rue Moyenne, with statements being made such as, if my children became Huguenots, I'd break their necks, I'd rather be disemboweled than become a Protestant, I'd rather leave the realm. You know, the services are causing all kinds of problems. But also in this document, which is very interesting because you rarely get an opportunity to hear from the inhabitants directly what they feel about the situation. And I must admit, when I first came across this document, I didn't realise its importance. It looked like a list of names, which it largely is, but every so often somebody made a comment. And they didn't have to make a comment, so when they make a comment, it's interesting, and the authorities have written it down. And we also get quite a lot of ambiguous and non-committal responses as well, which makes you think, OK, we're probably dealing with a Protestant here. For instance, they say that they will obey God, the law, and the king, which, you know, can't be questioned, but they're certainly not making a statement about their Catholicity or indeed issues around the services. And indeed, some go so far, and it's notable that it's people in the more notable individuals in the Rue du Temple who start saying, well, what authority does this commission have? This decision is up to the king, and it's not for us to decide these sorts of issues. So there's some very interesting responses going on there. But even more strikingly, perhaps, the overriding concern of those who expressed an opinion in this document was the discord which the services created within the local community. They were much more concerned with the divisions that were caused than they were about the presence of another religion. And it's a view perhaps that both faiths could share, this sort of lamenting over the divisions that had resulted as a result of the sort of Reformation. Okay. I'm going to conclude. When I was looking through my notes, back, you know, from way back, all handwritten, of course, sort of very pre-technological days, I came across a list of questions to myself about my work, my PhD work. It's rather amusing because I don't remember making it at all. It was kind of a pre-technological personal development plan, if you like, you know, rather horribly, but it wasn't that at all. But one of the self-reflective questions that amused me no end was that, what do I know, it said. And the answer I put was, more than I did. So I'm hoping that at the end of this paper, whether I've convinced you or not by my argument, that you know more than you did about certain aspects of the French Reformation. And I certainly don't know to what extent I'll have convinced you that the 16th century French Paris is a meaningful space to think with, not only with regard to clashes between the faiths as the normal sociabilities and sensibilities were challenged, but also as a unit of sociability and solidarity for Protestants. If I have at all, I'd venture that this is because it reinforces that the parish was a powerfully effective way of structuring community in the pre-modern period, and one so well established that those bonds were hard to break down, even when its members were divided among themselves. And I couldn't help thinking of a modern-day analogy, and some of us were talking about our modern-day relations with neighbours this morning. In the village community in which I live, I was thinking, what are the divisions there? And it's the village school that's the primary focus, I think, rather than the parish church of community there. And there's a marked differentiation between those local families that send their children to a village school and those who send them to a school outside the community, with its implicit kind of critique or rejection of the village school, that it's somehow not good enough, and thus erosion of community. And I think there's a quite nice analogy there. But those families can still rub along fairly well if other forms of solidarity are maintained. That was clearly not to be the case in 16th century France, where the ideological offence caused by a rejection of parish devotions and actions that seemed to threaten the very existence of the Catholic parish became insuperable obstacles to the maintenance of community. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Penny. Well, we have plenty of time for questions, so I will throw it straight open to the floor.
Do you believe this model can be applied to French rural communities, or is it just purely urban?
I'm very much a historian of the French urban community, so I don't talk from any kind of particular expertise. I think, as I said, it's clear that the French Reformation is largely an urban movement. That's not absolutely across the board, but certainly within these sort of northern communities, the conflicts seem to be very much going on within the towns, the larger towns in particular, and their interaction, if you like, with the rural parishes is usually very much they're getting attacked. One of the things about them being having to go out into the countryside to worship, and they're often complaining that the location of these services is in some rural backwater where they get attacked by people as they wander through marshes and woodland and those sorts of places, and that the local Catholic inhabitants are very hostile to them. So certainly in the communities I look at, there's very little sort of rural Protestantism, if you like. The Waladjuri has done studies of the peasants of Languedoc, where there's more in the southwest again, where there's more of a sort of concentration and arguments for saying it sort of grows out of sort of existing heretical sort of traditions going way back. He talks about the peasants tending to be Catholic and the carders, local carders, tending to be Protestants. And again, it's a bit of a sort of a stereotype, but it sort of works to some extent. And so those conflicts do exist in those communities, but I'm not sure to what extent it sort of fits with this model as such, because they're very few and far between, actually, the rural parishes where these conflicts really take place. It does seem to be very much an urban phenomenon, largely. Liz.
Rights in their parishes, if you have any at all? Or do you have any evidence, perhaps as an alternative, from cities where Protestants are petitioning for continued use of both space and institutions within parishes? I wondered if those two tied up at all.
I very much wish that I did. Because it would reinforce my argument nicely, wouldn't it? When the petitions are produced, certainly they tend to be produced as a community. So the petitions come to the Crown from either the Huguenots of the town, say, Troyes, or the Catholic community of the town, Troyes. So they think of themselves very much as a confessional grouping when they're... So that it certainly wouldn't be the, you know, Huguenots of the parish of Saint-Jean, Troyes, whatever. I think because of the... Even if they had wanted that, I think... This is quite a difficult one, because what they tend to do if they're going for the use of particular spaces, and this is interesting in the cases where Huguenots actually take over towns for periods of time, which churches are they actually using? They tend to head for the monastic or conventual churches because they're open spaces, so they fit better with their focus on the sermon and on preaching. So they tend to use those sort of buildings. But increasingly, they're asking permission to build their own churches. And actually, they start making that request from before the wars, actually being allowed to build their own temples, as they call them. So in that sense, my argument falls down entirely, I think, it'd be fair to say. I mean, they're not talking about it in terms of the parish as such and saying, we want our use of our parish church, but maybe that's just a very practical, you know, realisation that that's not going to happen. They're going to have to either build their own space or make use of spaces which sort of fit with their sort of services and so on. So I suppose, again, when they take over towns, there's lots of acts of iconoclasm, whether that's a kind of, they're kind of trying to clean up the church so that they can make use of them. So I think that's probably where I probably need to have a much closer look at is what use Protestants make of the churches in the towns where they actually take control. Places like Lyon, where they're in control for a year, but actually Troyes for a few months there. But it's not entirely clear where the services are taking place. They're increasingly going and having services outside because they need bigger spaces. These houses aren't big enough for them, so they're increasingly going outside. But then they have to deal with inclement weather, which is as true of northern France as it is of Britain.
As well as parish churches, though, other parish institutions have supported you. I mean, there is a bit more evidence
Yes, I mean, certainly there are petitions referring to issues around controlling their own poor relief. And I can't think of specific references to hospitals directly, but certainly in with regard to poor relief, they're making requests of that sort. And these petitions are actually quite detailed quite often. They are actually quite specific about what they want, and particularly about locations of where they're allowed to worship, because they... From 1562, they're not allowed to worship within the town. And they're trying to, because they're dependent on Crown, the Crown actually supporting their position. So after 1562, when the Crown says that Protestants can worship as long as it's outside town walls, then they're sort of stuck with the fact that it has to be outside. I mean, there are churches around the town, of course, which, but notoriously those... people in the suburbs tend to be more Catholic as well, actually. Seemingly, it seems to be very much in the heart of towns where Protestantism takes off. So that's sort of a very roundabout answer around that.
Does your research take you to 1598 and the Edict of Nantes? And if so, what happened then in a place like Troyes? I mean, was there peace and concord ever after? Or, I mean, were the conflicts over?
No, but what I mean in my work on pacification, there are quite a lot of edicts which precede Nantes, which have very much the same kinds of sort of ramifications. 1563, for instance, is probably the model one that is produced, the Edict of Amboise. That holds through the 1560s to a large extent, and then there are later ones which and eventually 1598 is really cobbling together of those earlier edicts, plus all the things they've learned in the meantime about the problems of actually establishing coexistence. And although the Edict of Nantes actually is largely because the Protestant minority has been eroded to such an extent that it's able to hold because of that, because they're no longer, and because a lot of leading Protestants, for instance, convert at the same time as Henry IV, who, of course, you know, they think they've got a Protestant king, but of course he doesn't turn out to be. So 1598 kind of resolves it in a way, although interestingly there are now arguments that Henry IV didn't want the Edict of Nantes at all. In fact, he wanted basically, you know, everybody to become Catholic as he had. That would have been his preference, and that's very much the position of the monarchy always, is this is a holding position until everybody will return to the Catholic fold. But those who've done work on the 17th century and what we call sort of, you know, the era of the Edict of Nantes, which lasts, of course, till 1685, we find just the same kinds of disputes coming up about places of worship, cemeteries, all these things. There's less violence. There is some, but I mean, it's more like the sort of day-to-day sort of intimidation and harassment which the Protestants have been putting up with for a long period. But you don't have these flashpoints of big massacres. But it's the same kinds of issues. And then as it gets closer to, well, goes into sort of Louis XIV, certainly, the restrictions on the Huguenots get read much more restrictively, if you like. They've been seen more liberally previously, whereas after that they've become more persecuted, if you like. So that's the sort of trajectory. But it certainly doesn't resolve things absolutely, 1598. No.
Yeah. Just sort of a follow-up to Liz's question, really, but from the other sort of angle. Can you sort of identify a sort of urban geography of iconoclasm in relation to Protestants and the churches in the parishes where they live? Are they more likely to target, you know, their own churches to try and purify those, or are they more likely to go to churches in particularly Catholic areas and target those? Is there a sort of a pattern or not?
That, again, is a very, very good question. That would certainly be worth looking at. I mean, a lot of the incidents of iconoclasm, well, they tend to take place very secretively, and sometimes the Protestants are saying, it wasn't us, it was the Catholics who did it, to get, you know, to put us in a difficult position so we don't get attacked. Sometimes they say that, and sometimes they back off, and it's quite clear that they know full well that who was responsible. And the attack on the Statue of the Virgin I mentioned, there's no attempt to pretend that it wasn't Protestants who did it. And it seems a lot of the iconoclasm seems to be more directed at those kinds of devotions. There's also what's known as the Beautiful Cross in Troyes, which again is very much in this central location. I have got it, yeah, number 17, isn't it? It's on the other one as well. I thought it was 18. No, it's 18 on this one. You see, change them around. Number 18, which is here. You can see how close it is to a lot of this locality, which is a big focus of Catholic devotion. And again, it's something that sort of Protestants. So they seem to be going for, not so much for their churches, and even others' churches, certainly in Troyes, they seem to be going more for these individual sort of icons and places of devotion. But it would be interesting, again, to follow up when they take control of towns, which ones they target. But then cleaning up your own parish church, because that's how they see it, be cleaning it up rather than attacking it, might be the way forward. But it would be interesting to see that, to follow that up. Yeah.
I was wondering whether, you know, what happens when they are pushed out of parishes, because clearly they want to be part of them, but they're not allowed to remain within them. So what they do in their own conventicles or in their own secret meetings, do you see any parochial structures, as it were, or substitute parochial structures emerging? Or do they explicitly see this as something temporary or not quite genuine? Or would you see that there are sort of roots of a new parish emerging there in the Protestant environment?
I mean, they're still living in the parishes often. I mean, they're not pushed out in that sense. They're not actually forced to leave necessarily. And even what I said about when there are many conversions, there's still Protestants who remain, but because they're not no longer seen as a threat, then that becomes less of a problem. But one thing is that their consistories tend to be organised pretty much in terms of social status along the same lines as you'd see of you know, the church wardens of the parish, the vestrymen and so on, be the same kind of sort of rank of people. The consistories tend to, again, you know, the elders tend to be appointed on the basis of social status to a large extent. So in a sense, that's kind of that's a social reflection as much as a religious one, I would guess.
Or is it by definition, once you have a consistory, you can't have a parish because the parish is territorial, whereas the consistory is, as it were, confessional?
Mm.
So is that a meaningful way of saying this is not a parish because it adopts a consistory?
Yes, we have to, because the consistory would consist of the whole community. That's right. And again, we have very few records of these consistories, particularly in places where they were in the minority, but there are references to them, so we know that they existed. And they had communion tokens, and they had all sort of paraphernalia around it. But I think again, thinking about back to these robust, hot-headed joiners, and perhaps the leather workers of the Rue de la Grande Tannerie, I think that's where the kind of parish solidarity is retained in a way, through their actions within their own sort of localities and having their own services and so on, which again the notables want to, you know, obey the law, you know, and not upset the authorities or the king, and they're often quite critical of the artisans for taking that position.
This is not really a question so much, it's just a point that you probably answered, I feel you've answered enough questions, but this morning I was talking about Harry the Glazier from Rye in Sussex, who turned out to be a Frenchman and to have a French family. And it was just very interesting to hear about parish life of the Huguenots in their home country from the point of view of knowing a little about it in this country and how they settled in huge numbers, the Huguenots from Dieppe and Rouen in Rye, and settled into the parish there so happily, very obviously why. But in this interesting period, before there was any kind of new Huguenot structure, they just adapted themselves into the parish, used the parish, met their French, had their French church in the parish. And so what you said was so very enlightening.
Well, thank you for that, because I'm just starting a new sort of project on confessional networks, clandestine confessional networks, and a lot of those are predicated on these exile communities. And Rye is one of the major places that they go to, as you say, from Rouen and Dieppe in particular. But it's quite interesting, they say that, well, lots of people turned up in the wake of St. Bartholomew in Rye, but went to London as soon as they could, seemed to be the line. You know, which is... yes, exactly. I thought that's slightly sort of the way, but the kind of, you know, rather... disparaging remark about Rye. I mean, I've got a nice tale of when the Cardinal de Châtillon, who's, although he's a cardinal, is a Protestant, turns up in Dover, and the great excitement to the court because the cardinal's turned up and he needs somewhere to stay. So the Queen says, right, we've got to sort out somewhere for him to stay, and they find out he's got 30 people with him. So, you know, actually finding it's not just a, you know, sort of one, you know, the guest, getting the guest bedroom ready, but this is a serious sort of, you know, so depending on the status of these people coming in as well and what sort of reception they get, I think it's...
Rye would just be a garret for you, your family person.
There's a point in bringing it down below the level of parish, we were talking about household this morning, and the progress of the French Reformation. Was it splitting families and households within the smaller units within the parish? I mean, individual neighbours, family networks, how were they reacting and interrelating?
They were split. I mean, you have families that are split, you know, different members of families, and even some families who all become Protestant. Some of them realise, you know, they're not going to get anywhere. They decide that their best way forward is to convert back. And they try and put pressure on their Protestant relatives to do so, and that causes all kinds of splits. Notoriously, some of the noble families are split right down the middle in terms of their confessional position, but there's lots of debate about how committed they are to their confessional position as well. So certainly families are split, and as I mentioned, neighbours certainly, yes. And I think, you know, clearly those animosities, I mean, they may precede the conversion, and just be exacerbated by it, but it seems to be particularly provocative if you've got neighbours of the other religion who are offending your sensibilities in various ways. One of the things the authorities do, for instance, is get neighbours to decorate the houses of Protestants so the offence isn't caused when processions are taking place, so that they're trying to actually keep the disruption to a minimum by actually undertaking those actions for them.
Any more questions for Penny? Chris.
Yes. The picture you paint is a very uncomfortable, stressful society where you're in constant danger of insult and physical assault as well. That's right, isn't it?
Well, it's also the nature of the records to some extent. I mean, funnily enough, this almost runs completely counter to what I try to argue more and more, which is that, you know, there are long periods of coexistence when they're obviously having to get on to a large extent. And of course, what we tend to see in the records is the record of disputes and when things get violent. There's a kind of everyday, a certain amount of everyday harassment and intimidation on a fairly low level, but that's also reflective of sort of relations between religious minorities and majorities in other circumstances as well, in Jewish communities, for instance. And
the solution for Northern Ireland, for example, and to some extent of historical Jewish communities, is to establish some sort of separate residential area.
And that's not tried.
Some of these streets have a generally Protestant character or generally Catholic character, but nonetheless, we've got a mixture of people. Would it have been impossible to sort people out?
It's never suggested, and the Protestants certainly never requested either, which you might think might be in their interests. What you do have is when people go into exile, they tend to board up their houses. So when these surveys go around, for instance, sometimes houses are boarded up. But that, I've also got cases where they board up their houses and carry on living in them, pretending that they're not there. During periods of persecution, there's a woman who goes back to have her child, and she's supported by her Catholic neighbours, you know, helping her to have the child and helping her, even to the point of she's actually doing tapestry work and they're selling it for her so that she can keep herself going, but she's sort of enclosed in the house. So there's no attempt whatsoever to think about segregation. I mean, the Catholics talk about expelling them all and, you know, getting, you know, basically expelling them from the community that way, but not ever any practical discussion of segregation in that respect.
That's one last question, sorry. I'm just wondering, in the burial register, are there any references to people dying from violent causes at all? In the burial register,
yeah.
Are there any references to people dying through violent causes?
They don't tend to refer to after 1572, for instance, where you find the records, there's a list made of the people who died, and they're all put in. Well, for instance, they're not necessarily buried when, you know, in a except in a pit, really, when that takes place, when it's done on a large scale. So often with, you know, violent actions, there wouldn't be a formal burial entry in the burial register, is what I mean, really. But what you tend to find is that their widows turn up in the taxation rolls, so you know they're dead. Like, I know that sounds awful. But, you know, you can't always trust lists of names to be absolutely accurate, because they're often produced by the Protestants themselves. And interestingly, after St. Bartholomew's Day, the Crown basically allows the widows to not pay tax for a while, which is very interesting as a policy.
Were the confessional divisions carried on into the commercial sphere? I mean, would a Protestant only employ Protestant servants, or only use other Protestant tradesmen, or if you say some tradesmen were mainly Protestant, and therefore they have to have Catholic customers, and vice versa?
I don't think it's quite as exclusive as that. I mean, obviously, you know, some of those solidarities are reinforcing, particularly in particular workshops, and as you saw with particular trades, I think there's a bit of reinforcement there. But I don't think it cuts completely across. Certainly, one of the ways in which confessional conflict affects commerce is that there are concerns about, for instance, Spanish merchants coming into, Liz would know about this in Brittany, Spanish merchants coming into Breton communities, for instance, and they're concerned that if Protestant worship is allowed, this will put the Spanish merchants off. But obviously there's no Protestant worship in Spain, so, you know, there are concerns of that sort, that it's going to disrupt trade. On both sides, actually, there's concerns about the disruption of trade as a result of restrictions of one sort or another.
Sort of picks up a bit on what Chris was saying and on that last question, really, which was a bit more thinking a bit more about these ties between different occupational groups and Protestantism.
Mm.
And are those occupational groups quite geographically geographically concentrated, and therefore are they kind of living in the same areas in the first instance?
Yeah.
And sort of related questions, are there
Is it generally that all different types of craftsmen are considered more inclined to Protestantism, to some more than others, or are there some groups that are sort of famously Catholic?
The famously Catholic ones are butchers, which is interesting, actually. You think butchers actually might profit, for instance, from Protestantism because there's no restrictions on fasting and that sort of thing. But no, butchers are often seen as being very much involved. It tends to be the sort of more literate trades that are seen to be involved with Protestantism, the more highly skilled, that seems to be it. So it's hosiers rather than weavers. Weavers tend to stay Catholic. You know, or people have broken it down to those. I think it's very hard to detect sometimes what the divisions are. But goldsmiths, for instance, who you think the Catholic Church would be one of their main, which interesting for the economic arguments, would be one of their main clients, go over to Protestantism in large numbers. And printers, of course, are notoriously sort of go Protestant, and they have access, of course, to the circulation of clandestine literature, which again is an interesting one. There's a great case in Troyes where a group of artisans, including a joiner called Collo, are caught reading Protestant texts, and their defence to the court is that they can't read. So they can't possibly have been doing this. And the court lets them off. I mean, that's a remarkable thing. They actually believe them. They actually say, okay. You know, I mean, it's remarkable to that extent. But, I mean, of course, one of them may have been able to read it to the others, even if the others were illiterate. And, you know, and how you prove your illiteracy. Well, sign your name or I can't. You know, it's sort of my name. It's interesting. But it's interesting how often the courts actually take those sorts of arguments. That they're prepared to... you know, as long as a great disturbance wasn't caused, and they were out in the field somewhere, and somebody happened to spot them, and that was about it, really. So, but certainly, I mean, there's lots of stuff about occupational issues, but I think the neighbourhood solidarity is more significant, or it works in tandem with the occupational solidarity, absolutely, and the parish solidarity. See, that's what I would argue. The parish is the unit that perhaps.
So something that might look like neighbourly solidarity could actually be occupational. I guess that was kind of
where I was. Okay. Yes, but I think it's, as I say, they go together. But the neighbourhood solidarity explains why in some towns it's the joiners, why in some towns it's the hosiers, in other towns it's the printers, who are particularly concentrated. You see what I mean? So actually the neighbourhood solidarity trumps the occupational solidarity there, because otherwise it would be the same group who is most prominent in each town. You see what I mean?
But that actually varies quite a bit.
Yeah, in terms of the one group that's associated with Protestantism, primarily, yeah. There's a kind of generalisation otherwise, but yeah.
I have a very small question. It's got me thinking about, so let's say like a guild like printers converted to Protestantism, how does that work? Are there records of deliberations where they're all sitting in a room together and say aye if you want to convert? I mean, what are the dynamics of that conversion?
I don't have guild deliberations of that sort. I very much wish... that I did. I don't think in any case that a whole craft group go over. Not all the joiners become Protestant. It doesn't work that way. And that's where, when you start arguing why it is, on an economic basis, for instance, it doesn't really work if everybody's motivated by that, because then everybody would go. But it's clear that some resist.
The whole groups,
so no, whole groups don't seem to go in that sense. You would have all the joiners, for instance, becoming. But it seems, well, they're disproportionately going to Protestant. That's where it is, where it's disproportionate, really.
We don't know that, but we definitely know more than we did. I think we can safely say. We have another session due to start at 6, so we can perhaps have a 5-minute comfort break. But before that, can you join me in thanking Penny again for leading such a stimulating session?